Two murders, 2 years apart, both on Martin Luther King Day in Savannah, Georgia. This is not the opening of a Shakespeare play, though like West Side Story, it is the story of a local gang, 5-7 East Coast Gangster Bloods. Agent Rob Santoro and Assistant District Attorney Matt Breeden guide us through the evidence that showed how the 2013 murder of Rebecca Foley led to the gang assassination of James Pastures in 2015. What you will learn along the way will show the inherently tragic nature of Savannah's gang problem. Listen in. And welcome back to Inside the Bar Beyond a Reasonable Doubt. I'm Christy Barker. I am a career prosecutor in Savannah, Georgia. I've been working in other counties, but I'm pleased, honored, really, to have with me Matt Breeden and Rob Santoro, both of whom I've worked with in different contexts and are obviously regular contributors to the podcast. I know I'm starting out a little serious here, but you know, we're going to be talking about a case that we were involved in that may have been one of the biggest cases that any of us has handled that went to trial. Is that accurate, guys?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, I think for me, and I know that we probably touched on this before, but like with me, Alan, and you guys, it was, and Judge Abbott on the bench, and I think it was probably the best it's gotten, I think, in my career, at least, you know, when it comes to thinking about trials and cases and working with competent people and things like that. I think, and that's not to naysay any of the other people that we've worked with. I mean, right, there's plenty of great prosecutors that I've worked with and had great, great trials with and everything like that. But the complexity of this and just the scope and magnitude of it, it was just kind of something that I've never come close to otherwise. So.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with that. I think the fact that everyone was all in too. I mean, I don't think anybody held back in this case at all.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I feel like it was really remarkable. And so I wanted to talk to you all about the murders of Rebecca Foley and James Pastures and how those two are connected and how it is that we were able to present that connection to a jury. And I know we're going to have an episode about the trial of this case, which is its own adventure. But you all were really a lot more involved in the decision-making that led to these cases being brought together. So let's start just generally with the murder of Rebecca Foley. That happened in January of 2013, is that right?
Yeah.
And I'm continuously optimistic that at some point I'm going to have Alan Sammons on to really talk about that investigation and part of the reason why it stalled. And obviously, I am going to be also discussing some of those delays and the effect that it had on the people that were involved in this case from the beginning. But I think it's really kind of important to just kind of set the scene a little bit. Rob, are you able to do just a little bit of that for me?
Yeah. Rebecca was murdered in January of 2013. In our office, Detective James Little was the lead investigator to start with. Alan was initially called out and a part of the first night where the scene investigation was done. There were some interviews done with Rebecca's boyfriend and roommates at the house where basically she was pulling in, got her nails done with her boyfriend, and then they were on their way home in two separate cars. She beat him home. to the parking lot of the apartment complex, and she was basically shot and killed as she was pulling into her home. And her boyfriend ended up finding her as he got caught behind a red light and ended up coming a little behind her, and he found her shot in her car. And essentially carried her to the apartment, almost to the apartment, and got help from one of the roommate's boyfriends, was like a Navy corpsman, so he did some life-saving efforts along with first responders when they got there. But unfortunately, she didn't make it. And that was kind of the initial scene. There was one projectile that was recovered from the vehicle, but had passed through her body. And then there was a shell casing found, a 380 shell casing found sort of at the entrance of the apartment. Little turn off, because it was like an apartment complex, so there was like a main drag, if you will, and then like little offshoots for parking lots for the apartments as you got deeper into the complex. So at sort of like the main turn off into her little parking area, there was a shell casing found. And then the next day, Evan Colquitt was murdered, and Alan was the next up on our team for that case. So then Alan and I kind of broke off for a little bit and spent a significant amount of time on that other investigation, which Alan solved. And then it wasn't until March where there was another shooting that happened that ended up in Alan's on Alan's desk. And that shooting was the shooting of a guy named Samuel Barnes. And there was a vehicle accident that happened that was involved with it, and the recovery of the murder weapon on that shooting. So then during that shooting, James Pastures and Kevin Smith were in that vehicle and were suspects. And that's kind of what led us to the suspects in Rebecca's murder ultimately. So that's sort of how that played out on a Reader's Digest version.
Sure. And from a big picture perspective, when that connection was made, the connection, ballistic connection, was made to this shooting that Alan had, he kind of segued back into assisting on Rebecca's murder. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's correct.
Just because I know you all try to work from evidence and you know what you actually see at a scene. I also know that in this case, the boyfriend was, of course, the immediate suspect. Was the working theory after the boyfriend was eliminated as a suspect in Rebecca's murder that it was a botched robbery, or was there a working theory?
Not that there was any really working theory that had been committed to. I mean, looking at the scene and the way it was, like the botched robbery thing had some support by the evidence, right? She was in her car, the way the shot was through the car, through the back window, it would have been as if she was trying to drive off, if somebody was trying to like get into the front seat or get at her into the at the front driver's seat, and she drove off, and they shot into the car as it was driving away. The fact that the car was kind of like in drive and just kind of slow rolled through the parking lot and actually like kind of crashed into another car in the lot, and then where the casing was to where the car was, some of that, I think, there was some support for that theory, but I wouldn't say that any of us really kind of committed to that. There was the roommate though, which lends some support to that theory as well. The roommate was had pulled in, one of the female roommates had pulled into the parking lot that same evening a little before Rebecca, and she said that there were two black guys that walked out in front of her car like slowly, like on purpose, and she kind of like beeped her horn and was like, "What the fuck, get out of the way," kind of thing. She couldn't really, she provided basic descriptions of them, but couldn't identify anybody. But that combined with the scene, I think, lent some support to that. There was probably some people out there maybe looking to carjack or commit a robbery, right? So there was some evidence to support that, but we really didn't, I don't think we really could say for sure.
So there's an investigation that occurs March to about May, June of 2013. but there are no arrests made on Rebecca's murder during that time. Is that right?
That's correct. There were some key admissions that came about during those interviews, that primarily Alan was involved with. One of which was, Kevin Smith said that he got the gun from the 380 murder weapon from a guy named Rod Parrish. So that came out. There were some relevant jail calls that led us to a guy named Jordan Campbell, who is Roderick Parrish's half brother, where Kevin was made a call and to Jordan, and then Jordan was like, Kevin basically was telling a man, I gave them folks a straight runaround. And Jordan was like, man, you gave him that man's name. Don't forget it wasn't just wasn't just him. It was two of your homeboys too. And so he kind of made some key admissions on that jail call. So that led us to Jordan Campbell. Some of these things, like in Jordan's interview at that time in 2013, they did ask him about gang affiliation, which, Jordan admitted to being a gang member at that point, but some of these guys admitted to that, which would play a bigger role later on. At the time, it was kind of peripheral, like contextual stuff for the interviews that were happening, but those ended up being big things later on. And then Rod Parrish was interviewed by Alan and Little, and during that interview, Roderick had told them that Kevin admitted to shooting the girl and was getting rid of the gun and made some admissions during that interview. So there was kind of like some finger pointing, internal finger pointing from the group of guys that were involved in this, but not enough to charge anybody. So there was no arrest actually made in 2013.
So, what changed over the course of time with this? Because, it's 2013. We've talked about on this podcast, like, I don't know how many times that this stretch of time, 2013 to like 2016, 2017, there was no shortage of violent crime, right? What changed over time that kind of brought this case back to the fore?
Well, I think like there was a lot of things that kind of happened. Some involved like internal politics of the police department. I was actually out of the unit for a while. I know we've talked about that on previous podcasts, so I'm not gonna revisit that. But so I was gone from the case for a while. Alan, had his own cases. Little ended up getting going to a different investigative unit after a little while. Essentially, yeah, there was nobody to work the case. It wasn't until Chief Lumpkin took over the position of chief and started running the police department, and Jennifer Foley had a meeting with him that kind of prompted the case to be reassigned. I ended up getting reassigned back into homicide, was given Rebecca's case primary as an investigator. But James Pashard had also been murdered in January of 2015. So during this time where nobody was working Rebecca's case, James Pashard had gotten murdered. And there was another death investigation of E.G. Richardson that was Jacob Schroyer's case that was ended up being kind of involved in all of this as well. So like there was a kind of a lot of things that had happened in between. But it wasn't until that, when Lumpkin transferred me back and gave me the case as lead, and Alan and I were able to work it again at that point, that we kind of started getting traction back.
So part of that traction, you mentioned that James Pastors got killed in January of 2015, and both of these murders occurred on MLK Day in their respective years.
Yep.
You were not lead on James Pastors' murder though, right?
No, I was still in SVU when James had gotten killed. That was Brandon Lord's case. And by the time I got transferred back to homicide, Brandon Lord had also been moved to a different unit. So James's case was kind of sitting on the shelf too. So Rebecca's and James's cases both were kind of sitting on the shelf. And when Lumpkin moved me back and assigned me the Foley case, we had requested that we get James's case as well because there was just a lot of overlap there. James was one of the suspects in Rebecca's murder. So that's how I ended up with both of them. I ended up taking both of them.
So, you, how was it that you figured out that these things may be connected in some way?
Well, I think it's like it's the evidence and the people, right? There were there was the murder weapon itself. There were the people involved in the murder that we knew of, and people involved in James's murder that we knew of.
So who was who? So you said that we knew about people that were potentially involved in Rebecca's murder, those being Kevin Smith, Roderick Parrish. Was Jordan a suspect at that point or not? And that was based on the jail call. And
And some phone records. We had some phone records back then too that put him in the area of the scene at the time it happened.
right. And Rod's phone was there too, as well, if I remember right. And James Patchers. So those four were suspects in Rebecca's murder at that point in time.
Correct.
Did you know how they were connected to each other?
Yeah, they all it was like it was a neighborhood group, right? It was a neighborhood group. They were all part of like the East Gangster Bloods, which was like off of 57th and kind of near like the Lesseps and that area, like 57th near the Lesseps, that whole kind of neighborhood. And yeah, so it was like kind of like a neighborhood group, and that was part of the, like I said, that some of the questions involved like their group affiliation, if they were Bloods. Most of them self-admitted that they were, they considered themselves Bloods. So, that was part of the connection, the neighborhood, the group or the gang, and then. Like the evidence, like the gun, the sharing of the gun, right? Like the gun used both in the murder and then in the shooting of Samuel Barnes. And then the jail calls, Kevin's jail calls and how they were connected and all that kind of stuff. That is kind of like a network.
So, did you have at that time, when you picked it up in James's case, did you all have suspects at that point?
In James's case, yes.
Okay, and who were those suspects?
It was Shaquille Sanders and Henry Speaks.
Were you aware of a connection between Shaquille, Henry Speaks, and the four people that were involved in Rebecca's murder or suspect? Okay, and
And it was all the same stuff. They were from the same neighborhood. They affiliated with the same gang. At that point, Shaquille Sanders was rapping like his he had a rap name. Kid Suave was his rap name, and Roderick Parrish was they called him Rude Boy. He was rapping with Shaquille, so there was a lot of overlap there. And then like, kind of the relationships got deeper, but I mean, social media postings of them all together. I mean, open Facebook stuff, just open source Facebook stuff where they're all flying the red flags. They're all doing the gang signs. It wasn't really easy to connect them to a gang. And then more importantly, in James's case, a guy, there was a surviving victim, who they tried to kill at the same time and didn't they weren't successful in that, and he cooperated, and so he knew these guys, so he named them at the time, who were the shooters. So there was some pretty good evidence in James's case as far as who was there. It needed to be tightened up for sure, but so there was stuff to work with. There were there was connections in a network that we knew of, so it's not like we were going in blind in 2015 when we picked the cases back up.
So I want to talk to, and I'm going to drag Matt into this. He's been sitting silently in the dark. But I, both of you all, have been involved in investigation of and teaching on the investigation of gangs. But I think the whole gang prosecution thing is something that Matt's taught on quite a bit. When we talk about these neighborhood gangs, tell me about, first of all, how, what you were able to figure out from this one. I know we've gotten some of that background from Rob, but how was this connected to other things, and what kinds of problems do you see with a neighborhood gang as opposed to a more national gang?
See, that's probably why I was brought into this case and why I got James's murder assigned to me. So I came to Savannah from Albany, where I was down there. I was the chief for 8 years, and Albany for years had the highest murder rate per capita in the country, like higher than Los Angeles, New York, Chicago, because they had 80,000 people and they would
We're
get.
not talking, we're ta not talking Albany, New York. We're talking Albany, Georgia, or yeah,
Georgia.
Georgia.
Yes,
Wow.
Doherty County, Georgia, South Georgia, a city or county of about 70 to 80,000 people would get 40 to 50 murders a year.
Wow.
And the vast majority of those were gang-related murders. And I started working on prosecuting most of those, and the vast majority of them were Bloods. We did have a small set of Crips. We had a larger set of Gangster Disciples, and then a very large set of Blood gang members, which were a neighborhood-based gang. And that's where you get into the difference. The neighborhood-based gangs versus your national gangs, they're just not as organized. And because of that, they are mainly concerned with increasing their reputation, increasing their territory, which makes them more violent. Your larger gangs, your gangster disciples, right? They want to make money. They don't want to bring law enforcement attention to them. You know, when I was in Albany, the leaders of the gangster disciples would make all of their members go to school. They would make them go to school every single day because they didn't want truancy cases. They didn't want all of these issues that come with you not being in school. They wanted to make money. Whereas your neighborhood-based gangs are more loosely organized and affiliated with a larger gang based upon, you know, colors, language, the way that they operate. But because it's a smaller organization that really is designed for, you know, we want our name known, they're more violent. And so that's the first issue you see with these neighborhood-based gangs.
So, and I just want to clarify, you mentioned that in context of Bloods being more neighborhood based. What do you mean by that?
Our set of Bloods was. So your Bloods at this point divide up basically in West Coast and East Coast Bloods. Most of our criminal street gangs, your Bloods and your Crips, started on the West Coast, spread across the country. But into the 80s, late 80s, and into the 90s, you started getting this split. There was a set of Bloods that formed in New York called Sex, Money, Murder, goes by SMM. They started in the Soundview projects in New York, which is the same projects I think Beyonce came from. And it was run at that time, SMM was run by a guy named Pistol Pete Rolock. He came up under Nicky Barnes, which was a large heroin dealer. If you ever saw the movie, was it American Gangster? He was the guy played by Cuba Gooding Jr. So not Denzel, but the other guy was Nicky Barnes. And so they spread south from New York. They still maintained a lot of the same things as Blood. You're still going to associate with Red. You're still going to have the same symbols, the same hand signs. They would do some different stuff, like they do associate a lot with the dog paw tattoo here. So you would see that on some people. But they spread south. And so what you get is a lot of people and these neighborhoods to enhance their group will associate with Bloods. And that's what we had here. So, like Rob said, these guys started around 57th Street, so they were 5-7 Bloods, is what they called themselves at the beginning. And they were run by a guy who went up to Virginia where he linked up with East Coast Bloods, and then they became a recognized set of the East Coast Bloods, and they became East Gangster Bloods or East Coast Bloods at that time. And so while they were a neighborhood-based gang, they were more organized at that point when all of this stuff started happening. They were more organized than a neighborhood-based gang. They were getting their orders coming down, some of them coming down, New York to Virginia to Savannah.
So, and of course, we're talking about this in large part in hindsight after all of the work that Alan and Rob did collecting all this information. But when you talk about this little neighborhood-based gang, that who would it have been that actually tried to pull in this affiliation? Would it have come from the neighborhood trying to affiliate? Or would it come from the Bloods trying to say, hey, no, you're our people. If you're repping us, you've got to do this our way?
It would come from the neighborhood trying to affiliate. The Bloods don't have to go out and recruit new sets. They don't have to, open up an office. It's not like a franchise where, I'm gonna open up a Chick-fil-A over here and get a whole bunch of business. People come to them because these neighborhood-based gangs, when they get large enough, they have a choice. It's you're either going to associate with the Bloods and you're going to be an approved set, or they're gonna come in and say, listen, you need to stop repping Bloods because you're not. And that can lead to a lot of problems. It came here through a guy named 57 Kev, who was the one that started it. And he's the one that really got them approved as an official Blood set.
And so once they became official, did they have like this whole structure? I mean, and I know that like Rob's sitting there smiling, like, 'cause he knows what I'm talking about. Like, there's a lot of information that y'all got in this investigation, and I'm trying to figure out like how to even condense this and talk about it and have it make any sense to people who know nothing about it.
They
So
had to go collect a lot of information. And that's the problem with gang cases. In this time in Savannah, there was no gang unit. There was nobody really working gang cases to the level they needed to be. They had an intelligence unit, right, SERIC, but that was for all of the intelligence in the region. It wasn't just for gangs.
somebody
And I
needs to explain this shit to me. Like, why did we have no gang unit?
Well, because we're a tourist town. And if you come out and say, hey, we've got a bunch of gangs and gang problems, people don't want to come and visit and spend money. And so you get a lot of cities that don't want to acknowledge that there are gangs instead of just saying, listen, yeah, we have gangs and we're going to do something about it. Everybody who lived here knew we had gangs, but nobody wanted to say that we had a gang problem and devote, we're going to assign officers to work gang cases and gather intelligence because that's what you need. You need that institutional knowledge and months of intelligence to build a gang case. You can't come out and go, I downloaded somebody's Facebook page or sent a search warrant to Instagram and got some records and they're throwing up signs and wearing red, so they're in a gang. You need history. And that's where Rob and Alan came in because they were able to go back. And when they brought James's case in, we had a lot of that information to go through. We had years of Facebook records. We had jail calls. We had all of that stuff that we were going to need to build that gang case and say, hey, here's how long this gang has been around. Here's the stuff the gang has done, and here's how many members it is, and here's how we know these guys are a part of that gang.
So, and I know like a megaton of that in this case came through the investigation of James Pastor's murder. But Rob, can you give a little context to how do you know what you're looking at? Like that, I'm saying this in part because at trial and to the public, there's this philosophy out there. It's like, well, anyone can wear red. Like I'm wearing a red shirt right now. Like that doesn't mean I'm in a gang. How do you know that when you're looking at it, this has gang meaning?
Well, I think the first thing you got to do as a law enforcement officer is understand the law. Like, you need to know the gang statute in your state and what constitutes gang evidence, right? It's not just wearing a color, but it's wearing a color for a reason with an intent. It's not just committing a crime, because you can be a gang member and commit a crime. That doesn't necessarily mean it's a gang crime, right? Like, I can be a blood and then go break into a house and steal money and then use it just for myself. And that's not really, doesn't make it a gang crime. But if I break into a house and steal a bunch of money and then give it to my gang to buy weapons or drugs, then it becomes a gang crime, right? Because it's in furtherance of the criminal enterprise. So, it is a lot of what Matt's talking about. It's building the history. It's understanding like the organization of it, right? Who gives orders? Can we prove they give orders? Yes. Okay. Like you have a Facebook conversation that's a group chat where, one guy's asking to go beat the shit out of another guy and then gets a green light from a specific person, right? Then it's like, okay. And then that's okay, that's good. That establishes authority, but then why is he going to go beat the shit out of the other guy? All right, he's going to beat the shit out of the other guy because he is a Crip and he's on the corner that we sell dope off of. So now that becomes a gang crime and it becomes in furtherance of the gang, right? He's going to fight the guy because it's encroaching on his gang territory, and we can establish authority that it was green lighted by a specific person who is in a higher rank within the organization. So you really have to understand all that stuff. Each gang is a little different, and I think that also is what makes neighborhood gangs a little bit more difficult to prosecute because you might have certain aspects of it, but it's a lot less organized. There's a lot less structure most of the time. So, like, really getting at the heart of that stuff is more difficult, I found. But it's not impossible to do. It's just you gotta work it a different way. So I don't know if that answers your question, but yeah, like you've gotta go through all those things. You gotta identify and learn what the language even means, right? Like a lot of the times there's different terminology that they use and you might not even know what they're saying. So like that might require you to interview somebody who knows what they're talking about. Somebody who's, intelligent, like probably somebody within the gang itself, or you get documentation from the gang. A lot of these times, like that's how these guys push knowledge out within their groups, is they'll send it out on a group text thread, or they'll actually have pieces of paper they hand out that says this word means this. This word means this, right? Like Aretha Franklin is a snitch. Like that's what that means, right? So I think like all of that requires a lot of attention to detail. It takes time. So yeah, hopefully that kind of answers what you asked.
So it does, in again, in the back of my mind, I'm like, I know exactly how what you're saying applies to the case that we ended up trying. I'm a little unclear on exactly when you didn't Matt get involved in any of the investigation on the front end, or was it after arrests were made?
So it was
No.
before arrests, but after most of the, I would say after most of the investigation was done, because you gotta remember Rebecca's murder was a year after I came to Savannah. So I had nothing to do with that. When James's case came in, we had a pretty good idea of who was involved at that point. Now that led to more things and what was going on and more evidence that we found. But a lot of the background investigation was done. When James's murder came in, it was pretty apparent to me that it was a gang-related murder, right? There was no doubt about that. We knew that this was at least gang-related. We didn't know how motivated by the gang it was at the time until people started to talk and we got some more information, interviewed the surviving witness, interviewed some people who were in the jail, things like that we knew it was connected. But we knew that it was motivated by the gang. And then once we learned that it was connected with Rebecca's murder, that's when the decision was made to put both cases together.
Okay, so you get involved in it. Did we know about the surviving victim at that time? Had he
Yes.
spoken to law enforcement at that point in time?
Yes.
Okay, I want to talk about that. And again, I think we're trying to show a lot of respect for this individual who, again, put himself really in harm's way. in this case. And Rob, I think you and Alan were both very involved, probably more you, I think, in talking to him. How did you get this man to talk to you?
Well, initially, he came forward pretty quickly after the initial shooting, right? Basically, it was an internal gang assassination, is what this was. It was to kill him and to kill James, because the gang believed that, number one, that they potentially were talking to the police. Number two, that they were responsible for that this other death investigation that I was talking about earlier that Jacob Schroyer had. They felt like that they were responsible for that death, which they were not, but that's what the gang interpreted the thing as. So it was like the gang eating itself. And so at that point, you have a decision to make, right? You either take your chances or you talk to the police, because your own group is out to kill you, right? They call it being on the plate. You're on the plate, they're gonna eat you, they're gonna kill you. So this guy was on the plate, and he intimately knew James's family, and they encouraged him to talk to the police. So that's basically what he did initially. Identified the shooters, I want to say within a day or two. It was very quick. And then nothing happened.
Why did nothing happen? I mean, this seems to be a theme. What is happening?
I don't know, because I wasn't in the unit at that time, so I can't speak to that. I think, Brandon Lord was relatively new to the homicide unit. He wasn't new to the investigations unit or division, but he was new to the homicide unit. I don't think he got a lot of good guidance. So I don't really put it on him, to be honest with you. I think it was on the supervision and the leadership in that office. That's my opinion. But basically no arrests were made. And then after a little while, Lord got transferred to another position within the department, and then nobody was reassigned the case until I got it.
So you took it, were, and there were a couple of witnesses involved in that homicide. Did you have to just re-interview everybody, or how did that go?
Well, yeah, I think one of the witnesses, I don't know, had ever actually been really interviewed. I think had been talked to, in a room with family members there and everything else, but I didn't really say much. Which that was an interesting part, because the other witness, so you're talking about, there's two witnesses. There's a surviving victim, and then there was just a straight witness. And the witness was also a part of this group, and I knew that kid from back when I was like a patrol officer. Just a stupid criminal trespass. He'd been banned from this apartment complex, and the apartment complex called the police, and when I got there, he ran away from me, and I of course caught him, and I chased him and I caught him. And he was wearing a flag at that time, and it was one of those where it's like, hey man, you got that flag, you a blood member? And he's like, yeah, I'm a blood. And he admits it, and look, that was a thing that my buddy Matt Smith, he's a cop in Maryland now, but he was like a really smart cop, and he was like, yeah, you should ask him about that. And I was like, okay, I will, and so but that was just something as a young cop. It was like, yeah, I'm trying to do a good job, right? And then come full circle, I had a relationship with the guy because of that, and I didn't mistreat him, right? I didn't tune him up. I just caught him, arrested him, asked him some questions, and then sent him on his way. So I'm not saying he was like my friend, but there was a relationship there, right? And
Yeah.
then from like it was like 6 years ago. But then to get back to your original question of how did we get him to talk to us, right? So after that, once he initially talked and then identified the suspects, he got out of town. I'm not gonna say where he went, because I'm not gonna do that, but he was nowhere close, and was basically just living in fear and hiding out for his life for over a year. And
No, that was
so
our
what,
surviving victim, right?
that's our surviving victim, correct?
Okay.
Not the witness. The witness was doing his own thing. I don't think they thought he said anything to the police or whatever. So he was kind of left alone. The surviving victim unasked. And so when Alan and I got the case or the cases, because I like to think that, like, even though it was assigned to me, like, really fully was Alan's case. Like, he I did work on it, yes, but like he was the one that carried that case. I focused a lot on James's case. So when we but we worked it together, and when we went down, or where, right, we went down to find this surviving victim, it took some convincing for him, because it was like, you got to think in his mind, right? Like, he's scared for his life. He told you who fucking did it, and then nothing happens, right? So, like, why should I talk to you, right? Like, why should I talk to you again and tell you the same fucking shit I already told this other cop, right? So we eventually spent some time, and we ended up, you know, we went to him where he was at and spent some time with him. And I think some of that was also credit to James's family. After James was killed, I developed a relationship with James's mom and dad too, and they were very helpful to the investigation as it progressed. And they were also frustrated too, because they knew who killed James, and nothing was happening. So I think initially the only reason the dude talked to us was because James's parents asked him to, and kind of vouched for me and Alan. But eventually, like, we built some trust, and that, like, I like to think, if I saw him today, I could shake his hand and everything would be fine, and, you know, we'd have a good relationship. But yeah, so he eventually did talk to us, told us everything again. But we did, like, a far more in-depth interview with him about the gang, because he had a lot of intimate knowledge about the gang. And at that point, it was about fleshing out the organization, you know, and he told us a lot of information that we were able to vet. And you know, he told us a little bit about how a conversation he heard between Roderick and Jordan related to the Foley case. There was a lot that came with the interview of that individual.
So, what was he able to tell you about Jordan and Rod in this conversation he had overheard?
The nuts and bolts of it were, like, they were talking about getting away with it and blaming Kevin Smith. Like, basically that, you know, they were involved, they were going to get away with it, and they were going to blame Kevin Smith for the killing of Rebecca. That was like that's like the short version. I'm probably not, I mean,
Sure.
that's my paraphrase. But yeah, that was like the gist of what he could tell us about that.
Well, and just that conversation, that intention that they're going to put it on Kevin, that kind of talks about like just the cohesion of the group, doesn't it? Like they're still like they're the undercurrents of people like not being loyal to each other.
Yeah, and it also, like, this surviving victim was part of the gang, but he wasn't deeply involved like James or Kevin or some of these other guys. And I think James was trying to extract himself a little bit towards the end there, but like he wasn't as deeply involved. And so, like, my point of saying that is that what he said kind of verified some of the other independent information we had about them blaming Kevin. So it had a layer of, like, veracity that, like, he wouldn't have known this other investigative information that we had. And so it was like, it even though it was like one conversation he heard, and it was like one little bit, it was like highly like substantial, and it was backed up by other stuff we knew. So it was kind of like it was a big piece of evidence, even though it seems like it was small.
So you have this conversation with him. He gives you a bunch of information about the gang. And a lot of this stuff, was this stuff that you knew, or was it stuff that you really had to run down?
Some of it was known, but a lot of it had to be run down. I'll be honest with you, like I wouldn't have considered myself a gang expert on the East Gangster Bloods until this investigation. So a lot of it comes from that, right? So like he explained the organization. Some of it, like I said, we didn't have knowledge of or know some of it, but a lot of it had to be vetted, right? Which it should have been anyway, even if we knew a lot of it, like just because somebody tells you something, you should still verify. So, yeah, a lot of it gave a foundation and we were able to build off of it from there. But I mean, just about everything he said was true. I mean, I can't think of one thing he said, told us about the gang that I never didn't find like to be like, backed up by gang paperwork or social media evidence. Like everything he said was spot on.
So he gave you some of the structure, to my recollection, of the local set. Is that accurate? And Matt, I want to pull you into this too. So after the surviving victim was interviewed, was that the first time you started really looking at what kind of social media that y'all had for this, or how did that work?
It was. That's when we really had to start data mining and going back and saying, all right, so we know this stuff, right? When he gives us lots of information about the gang, it's, a lot of it is generic gang information that I can say about any blood, but we have to verify that and apply it to these individuals. And that's how we were able to do that. So going back through all of that, we were able to get just a wealth of information. One of it being just surprising, like how long this had been going on, because you have to realize the decision the gang made to murder James was not an overnight decision. It wasn't that there were two or three people sitting around and said, we're worried about this guy. We need to do something about him. As Rob said, it's called being put on the plate, right? That you're going to be eaten by the gang. And that process, took over a year. That all had to be vetted. He was basically investigated by the gang, and that's how that works. The gang will carry out its own investigation before you get approval to kill another gang member. And so we had that information, how long this had gone on, and then just going back through the social media to see how the gang had evolved. Because it did start as a neighborhood-based gang, the 5-7 Bloods off of 57th Street, that changed over time. So you're able to see how the gang started adopting more and more of this national blood terminology and structure and organization. And we were able to get books of knowledge, which contains all of the gang terms. So when you become a gang member, it's just like going to work anywhere else. They're going to give you your employee manual. And it's going to be like, all right, here you go. Now you're a blood. Here are the terms you need to know if you're a blood, right? Like Rob said, there's on the plate. You need to know what that is. Aretha Franklin is a snitch. All these things you're going to say to bloods, for instance, and Rob can reply. If I were to see Rob on the street and say, yo, twin Glocks, he would say what?
Two G's.
Exactly, right? So you have to learn how to operate within the organization. And you get that book of knowledge that has that with it. Along with that, it had the history of the Bloods, which was accurate. So you have all of these founding members that they honor and look up to. And then it had an overarching organization. It had the Savannah organization. It had the New York organization. So we had names, street names of blood members in New York. And then when you're in prison, there's a separate prison organization because when you go in, prison really is divided by race and not gang. And so Bloods, Crips, more likely to group together there than they are on the outside. But there is a prison organization. It's called Behind the Wall, and it would say G-Wall. And we had the organizational structure of the gang in the prison. So now when we go to trial, we're able to not just show that, hey, this is six people in Savannah. They are part of something that is a much larger problem.
So, where did that book of knowledge come from?
The one we had came from Shaquille Sanders's car.
So, Because the surviving victim was able to make identifications, and he was able to identify Shakeel Sanders and Henry Speaks. Is that accurate?
Yep. Then warrants were executed by everybody who was handling the case. Can't remember who signed which warrants and did what, so I'm not going to get into all that. But, houses were searched, cell phones were taken and downloaded, cars were searched. So we would find all of this information. The book of knowledge came from Shakeel Sanders's car. But you would see the same things on their Facebook page.
And I want to talk about that too. There's some photographs. I am intending to put some of this up on my podcast Facebook page too. But some of these photographs, there are all these hands signs. And people talk about signs all the time. Looking at them, how do you know what they are and what they mean?
Generally, just prior experience, right? You don't know it until you have to learn it. Most of them are the same, but you will see gangs that do different hand signs, right? For instance, I can't do it because there's no video, but our 5-7 Bloods, you hold up your hand like a five and then put your other hand down, like make a gun and put a seven, right? So some of those are going to be your more local gangs. And all you can really realize and see is, I see all of these guys constantly doing this in their photos. It must mean something. And then through interviews, right? That intelligence, like Rob talked about, how he arrested a guy and just asked him some questions. That's how you learn, is your officers asking questions, documenting it in
Yeah,
their
I was gonna say, then
reports.
you document it. You don't just
Documenting it
ask, you
is
gotta
the important
document.
part, right?
Yeah.
It's, you fill out an FI, a field interview, and you submit that up, and people get this stuff and say, all right, so on, February 12th, 2013, Rob Santoro pulled up and, saw these five guys outside the street corner, and they talked to him. They were all wearing the same color. Here's what they're doing. And that's how you're able to build that.
And some of these symbols are really hard to understand what the point of it is. Like, there are a couple that have gang members, putting like little eye things on.
Those are
That's
bees, Christy.
yeah.
they're bees. I'm sorry.
Those are
Those
bees.
are upside down bees. It's like such a Kevin thing. He's such a goofball. I'm sorry. But they put them over their eyes. So how do I know it's bees? How it could be anything. It could be like childish sunglasses. There's so much of this seems like middle school, grade school stuff, right?
I mean, because honestly, it is base level, most of it is, right? Other than it is now used to identify a criminal organization. But I mean, that's what it is. It's how we distinguish ourselves from others. It's how we associate. And now you're part of our group because you know how to do this.
And I remember too, there were some videos and things that were not necessarily used in this, except for maybe a sentencing, where you've got Shakeel Sanders as an example doing what you called stacking. What is stacking?
Stacking is basically throwing multiple gang signs one after the other.
Okay. And obviously, it translates to something for those watching, right?
It can. I mean, a lot of it is showing your inherent knowledge of the gang and where you are in the gang because you're able to just constantly throw all of these signs. You must be, as we saw in one of our cases, the super duper blood.
True.
Right? It's this idea of, listen, I'm not just, because try it yourself. If you try to throw up one gang sign, you're going to have a hard time. I mean, they would do 10 in a row. And yeah, it does mean something depending on sometimes the order in which you do it, but it really just shows your level of involvement in the gang.
Yeah, you're reminding me too that this particular gang set was generational. Shakeel Sanders' father, Yusuf Sanders, was involved in this. And I just suddenly had this intrusive thought of what happens when you get to be old like Yusuf? Is it like you have arthritis and you can't stack anymore?
What does Pops do? I
Or
mean,
Pops do.
you're at that point, you're basically, you're the consigliere of the gang, right? Which is what He was. You hear all these in these interviews and on these jail calls, I should say, and in the South, like, what do? Go push up on Pops. Go ask Pops what to do. I mean, because he's been around for a long time. And so you would see these guys going to Yusuf Sanders, all of them, and just asking for his advice.
And
Now,
just
here's
for a little bit
interesting.
of clarity too, Shaquille Sanders was one of the top ranking gang members of this set at that time. I think it was basically like it was like 57 Kevin and then Shaquille. So he was high up there, and that, just again, his father was one that they all relied on for a lot of stuff.
Well, and there was a discussion about Shaquille Sanders' son being, what was he? What was the term? They
Blood
call
drop.
him
Blood drop, yeah.
And so they were teaching this little kid how to do all the signage too. You've got pictures of it.
Yeah, and what a blood drop is like you're born into it, so you don't have to be beat into it. Like, 'cause otherwise what this set does is they to get in, you got to be beat in. We had abundant evidence of that. We had Facebook conversations of a kid getting beat in. One of Pujara's cases, we actually had a guy who provided us with a beat-in video. Like it was actually like a videotape of a dude getting beat in. So that if you're a blood drop, you don't have to get beat in. You're just born into it.
So, the beat-in, were there other things to get initiated into this blood set other than the beat-in, or was that it?
I mean, you can be born in, which is your blood drop. You can be beat in. There's a smaller group of people that can be what is blessed in, right? So if you got a relative who's a blood, they basically kind of just let you in. There is a small group of women who have been sexed in that has really gone away. That's just not something that really happens anymore. Most women are beat in. They fight other women and other girls.
Lovely. Lovely. So for this set, how did that influence what happened in this case? So what were we able to piece together for what happened in these two murders?
I think the way it influenced the case the most at this point was it connected everything. It gave us the reason to try these two murders together, which is to give the jury the entire story of what happened. That's what a trial is. You're telling a story. And you don't want to leave parts of the story out, right? We don't have cliffhangers in trials. We tell the full story. And we wanted to be able to now tell the story of the gang from the gang's creation, how these people got involved in the gang, up to some of the other crimes they've committed, to the murder of Rebecca, to the murder of James, and why they are all related to the gang. And so that gang gave us that glue, to put all of this together.
Well, and I think we talk about this in other contexts, and I know it has come up. The gang is the conspiracy, right? Like, if the gang is committing crimes, and this crime is in furtherance of that gang, it is all part of one big conspiracy. Is that accurate?
Generally, it can be like obviously gang crimes can be separate, right? We can all be in a gang right now, and two of us are in one state and one's in another. If Rob goes out and commits a crime that's in furtherance of our gang, and then I go and commit some other crime here, like, yeah, maybe we don't try those together. But these were so intertwined that James was involved in Rebecca's murder, and then James was murdered because of his involvement in Rebecca's murder. And that's why they needed to be together.
All right, so tell me how we were able, what evidence do we have of that? How do you prove that? Anyone, Rob?
Well, I think like some of the stuff we haven't really gotten into yet, but the investigation evidence, right? As Alan and I continued to work the cases, we were able to get, additional statements from these guys, including Kevin and Roderick, where, with relation to Rebecca's case, for instance, Kevin was like, we were just out there looking to hit some licks, all four of us, right? Me, James, Rod, and Jordan. We were out there and we were looking to hit licks. We were gonna rob people and we were gonna break into cars and steal shit because that's what we do. So basically, like, they were out there, right? Going back to your botched robbery theory, that's what this ended up being. But they were out there looking to hit licks because that's what the gang does. They were doing it as a group, and furtherance of the group, they would pool it all. Once they got all the loot they got, they were going to come back. They'd split it all and shit. And so it was very much a gang related crime that happened to Rebecca. So there was that piece, and then we ended up interviewing a guy named Jay Buckins, who was Roderick Parrish's cellmate for a while in jail, and Roderick ended up confiding a whole bunch of information in this guy, and basically talked about Rebecca's murder, how it happened, how him and his brother were going to blame Kevin, and blame James. He specifically said they were going to blame the driver, and James was the driver in this case. So there was a lot of information that came in through him that tied it to the group and tied Rebecca's murder to the gang and the group. And then, of course, the motivation for James's murder was 100% gang related. The gang thought James was potentially talking to the police, and then, yeah, again, they thought he might have been responsible for this other death of E.G. Richardson, which played a big role in their decision to just say, yeah, we're going to kill him, for both reasons, right? They were suspicious of him during Rebecca's investigation that he was talking. And then I think the E.G. Richardson death put it over the top for the gang, and they just basically said to execute him. And then, of course, we had the gun. That gun, we ended up getting ballistic evidence, not connecting it just to the Samuel Barnes shooting, which was the March shooting of 2013, but there was also a 2012 shooting we were able to ballistically connect the gun to, involving Jordan Campbell and Shaquille Sanders, where they were identified in that shooting. So now you're connecting the players not just through the gang itself, but also the gun, right? They share the gun to commit crimes, and that was kind of the crux of a lot of our evidence. And then, of course, all the social media stuff that connected them together with other crimes and everything else. There was a lot. I mean, it was difficult, and Matt can speak more to this because he did a fantastic job with this. It was the difficult thing to, like, parse down to a digestible, like, format and presentation. Like, there was so much there, like, to choose it and then to try to, like, make sense of it. Like, him and Jameson did a fucking awesome job on that, because that I don't know that I would have been able to do that the way they did.
And I think there was, to your point, Christy, there was some specific evidence that came out that we had that really tied James's murder to Rebecca and the gang being worried about him. So in the jail calls, everybody was worried about who was snitching. And I think there was one call, and I can't remember. I think Kevin was the one on it, but and he might have been the one where he was talking to Yusuf, where he's like, "Well, who's talking?" And they mentioned James, and he's like, "It must be him." Because that's when we really heard that. We're like, all right, so the gang is on to James. And then when we talked to the surviving witness, our cooperating witness, he was able to tell us things that James had been telling him leading up to James's death. Because this wasn't, again, an overnight decision. James had been worried for months that something was going on. He would talk about how people in the gang were acting flaky. He mentioned that probably a week before his murder, James tells this to the witness that James was called over to Yusuf's house, and he really thought that they were going to kill him then and there. And so he was worried about going over to Yusuf's house. And so we have all of this evidence that they're talking about, hey, we're worried about James. He must be the one snitching. And then the same times, James is talking to people saying, listen, I'm worried that the gang is coming after me. At one point, James had gotten rid of the guns that were in his house, and he was making efforts to get those guns back because he was so worried that somebody was going to come after him.
And if I remember right, he is killed during this period of time when the guns are out of the house. Is that right?
Yeah, he had made arrangements for the guns to be dropped back off. Now, some guns were in the house because somebody had there was a neighbor that saw somebody walking in with a like a large duffel bag. And so we found out that there were guns in the bag. But James was called, basically called out of his house by Shaquille Sanders and Henry Speaks. And they assumed that he was the only one home. They didn't realize that there were basically going to be two witnesses. There was somebody in the car that they didn't know was there, sitting outside, and then there was James coming out, as well as our cooperating witness who saw what happened. And so when James came out, they pretty much immediately started shooting at him.
And he did not survive. The other surviving victim was shot as well, am I right?
No.
Yeah, he got away. He ran. So he said he took off and he just kept running. Now he said that Henry ran after him shooting, is the
Yeah, he
way that
was
he
shot at.
described it.
Yeah.
He
Yeah.
said that Shaquille kept shooting at James and
James.
Henry
Yeah.
ran after him shooting.
Yeah.
So I do have to like tip my hat to you particularly, Matt, but to both of y'all for how you presented this to a jury. I actually was looking
Twice.
twice,
Twice, yeah.
so when I was looking through, because I actually still have PowerPoints and stuff from the original trial of this case, and there were like separate PowerPoints. I think there was one like overarching gang one that was 35 slides. How you got it down to 35, I still don't know. And there's like a separate PowerPoint for each of the gang members, including the witness, the surviving victim. Actually, the surviving victim, I don't think it really had one. But like some of the other people that were going to be players in this trial. So like you really set the stage. That was pretty well done.
Well, thank
So,
you.
but you have.
Defense thought so too. This was the one where Matt talked about last time, about how the defense was like objected that it was cumulative. And he was like, yeah, I agree. There's substantial gang evidence and substantial evidence of guilt. However it played out, but that was hilarious.
It was really funny. It was really, really, really funny. But it was also what made. The second trial, we were able to bring in jury tampering on top of every other gang crime you could think of that was involved in this case. And I say that in part because some of the gang evidence, so we have to prove that this gang or this group of people is involved in a criminal street gang. And there were all these Facebook posts about, hey, we're gonna go rob this person, or hey, we're gonna get a gun and do this, or and these are Facebook posts like Roderick Parrish has them, Shaquille Sanders has them, like all of them have on their feed somewhere, like some either a picture of them doing gang stuff, messages about like going and committing crimes, guns, doing all kinds of stuff with this. I mean, it was kind of overwhelming, and you guys condensed it into this one day of testimony, I guess. Was it just one day? It felt like.
Most of a day. I think we finished. We started direct at 9 and we finished around 2:30, 3 o'clock.
So that this terminology, and it's still like you talk about, oh, twin Glocks, two G's, that being the call, which I probably was fed that, and I was like, it was still in my brain for a very long time. But as soon as you say it, it's like, what am I supposed to say back? I don't even know, because it's so abnormal to me. But all of that language, like blat, what the hell is blat?
Love all the time. Well, like what was great about it too was like, because we had from not only Shaquille Sanders, but like, and I know you'll get into this more with like the trial episodes or episodes, whatever it ends up being. But like we did warrants on their jail cells too, and we got more gang terminology and gang knowledge out of the jail cells. And so we had like a glossary of terms. And so like not only could we provide it to the jury for them to like reference, but like it also was like something where like you don't have to take our word for it, man. Like we'll put up the Facebook post of like twin Glocks, two G's, and then right next to that we're gonna put up the piece of paper we got from, Henry Speaks's cell that has the glossary of what twin Glocks and two G's is in their own writing, right? So it's like it was great because it was like not we weren't asking the jury to take my word for it. It was like the only thing that we were asking them to take my word for is that I got it out of that cell, right? Which is like a basic fact, right? Like anybody could verify that. But like it so it was great to have the social media and also be able to reference like their own writings and everything like that. I think that's really what made a huge impact in our ability to do it. But to do that though, like you're talking about having to do that on pages, social media pages, grab it, right? And then a scanned document of their glossary and cut and paste. And they, Jameson did a whole bunch of, visual stuff in the PowerPoint. I know Matt, you did too. So like it was a lot of work, man.
It wasn't that mistrial really helped us because Rob talks about searching the cells. We got a lot of stuff out of there. That was when, you'll probably talk about it in the trial. Our first trial abruptly ended, and Rob gets super pissed, starts yelling, and just disappears. And like later, he shows back up. Like gang Santa with two sacks of evidence from these jail cells, and he's like rolling in. And like I remember we go into the grand jury room and he just dumps them out on the table, and it was just tons and tons of material to go through, and that's how we were able to find other information, that hey, these guys are still involved in this, they are still communicating, they're still working together
And trying
to
to fa yeah
fight this.
fabricate yeah fabricate stories and defenses and everything else.
Well,
And
right, and
so,
that was incredible. I'm sorry, you had a point. Go ahead.
no, I was just gonna say like that helped out a lot in trial. And the side story to that, which is always the funny story, which I don't know if we're gonna talk about in the other episode or not, is we get all this stuff and we're getting ready to start trial two, like 3 days later, we've got to show it all to the defense. And so most of the defense attorneys came in to look at it, and two came in together. And one of them went through like every piece of evidence, and one of them did not. One represented Henry Speaks, and one represented Shaquille Sanders. And of course, one of them found the letter that was written from Shaquille to Henry of, hey, here's what our story needs to be. And he was such a nice guy that he didn't tell his defense attorney friend about it and just kept it to himself. And so when we started the second trial, that defense attorney comes in and says basically the same thing that he said in the first trial, but we have a letter that contradicts it. Had someone told him, hey, I found this letter, he probably wouldn't have done that, which I found greatly amusing that they won't even work together. Like the attorneys won't. The defendants were working together more than the attorneys were.
That's true. That is so true. I think that's part of what was so remarkable is how much these people, and you see it though in their social media posts and stuff too. They grew up together. All of these gang members, or a lot of them, grew up together in this neighborhood. And so there was a lot of loyalty. There was a lot of, like, you see Shaquille Sanders, he is, high up in the ranking of the gang, and he's still somebody that they rely on for, like, hey, how am I supposed to handle this, man? Like, please tell me what to say, how, and what ALPO do I have to memorize, right? Like, that was another one of those terms that I'm not entirely over the fact that they call this information that they've got to memorize ALPO.
Dog food, man.
What?
Dog food, man.
Dog food, yeah, because apparently everyone who is a blood or in this set is a dog of some kind, I guess. But they have, and they we had everything. I mean, it was incredible the amount of information because you have, the listing of the ranks, you have everybody's gang name. Like, I'm that bloody, whatever, like, Bloody P, or whatever it is that they go by in the gang, and they would have that repeat in the social media. And they had all these things they had to memorize, which again, it feels very childish, but it was so important to them. It was such a religion to them that they would fight and die for it, right?
Yeah, this shit is real, man.
Yeah. And you look at how much damage. I think that that's part of what I kind of want to talk about too. I'm almost winding down a little bit because we do have a lengthy episode on the trial itself, which I think was great. I want to talk about just the impact of gangs like this on a community. You see it like just being guys get together, right? Like that's how it's portrayed, and there's like good stuff the gang does. They even had some of that in their social media that I saw. It's like, oh, look, these people are protecting businesses or protecting a home or whatever. That's how they portray it. What is it that you see, because y'all have dealt with it more, as being the real issue with gangs that we need to address?
You want to go first, Matt?
Sure. I think the issue I see and what you have to realize is that in areas it becomes a lifestyle. And not only does it become a lifestyle, it becomes a hereditary lifestyle, right? In the sense of if you live in one of these areas and you're not in the gang, now you have to worry about being preyed upon by the gang. And so there are people, especially younger kids, who join a gang because, well, I want protection. Because of where I live. And now they're caught up in this lifestyle because we weren't able to eliminate that gang and stop them from recruiting. But it also becomes hereditary. You talk about Yusuf Sanders and Shaquille Sanders being born in the gang and Shaquille calling his son a blood drop. Had we not put Shaquille Sanders in prison, there's no doubt that in, 12 years, his son would have been a blood. Because that's how he's growing up. That's what he grew up in. And you start to see how it expands and takes over basically areas of your city. We all know which areas are run by which gang in Savannah. I can tell you right now from our murders, if you go to 40th and Burroughs, you're going to see Crips. I can tell you where the Bloods are. And so you start to see how areas are taken over by these gangs. And I think that's the aspect of how it expands and just how far it can reach, which is the largest or biggest problem we have.
And the lifestyle that you're talking about is not just like, hey, they're groups of people and they're wearing clothes. It's the ripping and robbing. It's the willingness to shoot complete innocent bystanders, but also to shoot and kill to discipline within their group, I think. It's a problem. But Rob, you were on the ground with it. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the biggest thing that I've seen is like, I don't know that I've just my personal experience, I don't know that I've seen any benefit to criminal street gangs. Like I haven't seen like the forcing your gang members to go to school every day. Like, I haven't, not saying it doesn't exist, but I haven't seen that. Like, what I've seen is like it just destroy communities like inside and out. So like, right, like Rebecca is like the innocent victim in all this, right? She had nothing to do with any kind of gang and yet she falls victim to it. And James, the last time I saw James, I had asked him if he would come talk to me about Rebecca's case, and he said he would, and it didn't happen. He ended up getting killed. So that never happened. But even though it seems like James was probably trying to distance himself and starting to not to trust the gang, it destroyed him and his family as well, right? So even though he was a part of it, like he ends up dead because of it, and his family has to live with that, unfortunately, just like Rebecca's. So just because you're a part of it doesn't make you safe from it. And not even in the same way as like, a rival gang, right? Like, okay, you expect rival gangs to war, and like I think they all sort of like accept that as a reality, right? Like, I might die fighting with the Crips, shooting the Crips or whatever, but like even within your own group, it happens. So yeah, I mean, I just see all of the violence and the tragedy behind them, and so like there's a reason they like Matt said, there's a reason they come to be, right? It's protection and probably lack of family, lack of parenting, all that stuff. They fill a void, but there's got to be a better solution than this.
There's no positive aspect. I think we tried a case, Antoine Drayton, which was a gang murder. Rob testified in that as well. And the defense attorney argued that gangs were a positive influence on people. And it was just the most absurd thing that I've heard. They don't. And when we talk about, Rob mentioned, and we talked about GDs, forcing kids to go to school. I mean, they're not doing that so that these kids can get an education. They're doing it so that these kids don't bring law enforcement attention on them. You're going to school as a GD from, 8 o'clock till 2:30, and from 2:30 to 11 o'clock, you're out on a corner. Like they don't want you. Now they do send people, especially the GDs, send people to college. We've had GDs that are in city government. We've had GDs that are, in law enforcement. Because that's what they are doing. They are trying to get people in positions to infiltrate these organizations where they can control what is happening to them and get information. So it's not a altruistic goal by any means. It is done to further their criminal objectives.
Yeah, and of course, we've seen the kinds of corruption, and that can be public corruption too. But the corruption of society that comes from that approach, right? So, but I feel like, it's so important to get this information out there about what it takes to try a case like this, the kind of labor intensive thing this ends up being, because I contributed some to the prosecution of this case, but I was so late coming in. All of the real legwork had been done, and I've got to admit that I was a little spoiled with that. I was learning right along with the jury, like, oh wow, that's really cool. I mean, I'd seen a lot of it. I'd seen a lot of the Facebook posts and stuff like that, and been through a lot of that in the context of my part of the trial. But seeing the overview that y'all were able to give, I think is exceptional. And it doesn't happen in every case. It certainly doesn't happen in every gang case or gang trial or cases that should be gang cases. So I feel like y'all bring so much expertise to this that it really makes such a difference. Is there
Well,
anything
I'll
else?
say too, just to add off of what you had, Christy, and then that'll probably be it for me. But like, I will say that I think that, like, in order to present it, like, I think, not everybody could be Matt in the way that they present like a gang investigation. But you have to have some sort of technological fluency as a prosecutor to present a case like this. Because if you were to sit there and put up like a picture, a Facebook picture, and then fumble fuck around and put up a picture of the handwritten notes and everything like that just presentation, although it's the same material that we would have presented, like, it just presents so shitty, and a jury's gonna be like, what the fuck? Like, you'd have to have some kind of fluency in order to make it so that, when you present it, it's like in a digital format, you feel comfortable and confident with the way you're presenting it, like either whether it's on a TV. Like, I'm not saying it has to be the most sophisticated thing in the world, but like, you can't be like, you can't be like fucking putting it on an overhead projector and expect that to go over well, right? Like, it's too complicated and too complex of a thing that, like, really to do it well, like if you're a prosecutor and you want to be a good gang prosecutor, you have to develop an ability to put together like a halfway decent PowerPoint, or or whatever. You have to have that ability to do that, or work with somebody who does, and then you have to be familiar with it enough that you can work the fucking thing during the trial. And that goes for investigators too, right? Like, you have to be fluent enough with technology that you understand what these dudes are using now. Like, it's not Facebook anymore, right? Like, that was 10 years ago now, right? Like, these kids are using, Snapchat and all this other shit, right? WhatsApp. Like, you have to keep learning the technology in order to present the best and to present the best evidence. So that's like one kind of final thought for me on the gang stuff and gang investigations from law enforcement side of it.
Yeah, absolutely. Is there anything else, Rob, while we're still talking about you, that you would add to, like, or think people need to take away from this?
No, I don't think so. I think just kind of what I said before. It's like, gangs eat up inside and out. They just destroy people and families, and it's just not good. And yeah, I think, like Matt touched on it at the beginning, like I remember specifically a press conference that Chief Lovett held when he was the chief down in Savannah and said, "We do not have a gang problem here." And that was like right around the time that this Rebecca Foley murder happened. So like, it's like, what the fuck are we doing, dude? So I think the first thing is you have to acknowledge that it exists before we can try to find solutions. And like, in my mind, like, this isn't the right platform to find a solution, right? Like, we deal with the back end of this problem, and it's like, you're not going to arrest your way out of it. So it's for other, I think, disciplines to figure out how to make this stuff better. I mean, we could be a part of that, but it's not it, it wouldn't it shouldn't be our primary function.
No, we're certainly not going to be able to give people therapy. That's not what the justice system is for. We're not going to be fixing the social ills. Matt, what do you think? I actually, y'all were making me think that I needed to look back at Roderick Parrish's lyrics, which you got from his jail cell, which is just classic. But the lyrics and everything else, we hear about that as being part of, like, oh, well, gangs, they're not in a gang, they're just in a rap group, or
It's
whatever.
art. It's
It's
art. Yeah. I mean, let me try to answer your question, because right now I have vertigo since Rob was like filming the Blair Witch Project from his cell phone throughout his house. But we get that a lot in trials, that these are just rap lyrics, right? That it's art. I'm just saying stuff. It is not. It is confession as an art. They are describing exactly what they know and what has happened. I've had that defense in trial. There's an expert that goes around the country. There's a group of experts, honestly, that go around and have this idea that rap lyrics are simply that, and that they are overused by law enforcement. And they can be, but not when they're used by law enforcement that has extensive knowledge in the field in the case. And that's the difference here. We didn't have people coming in and going, "Hey, he's rapping about a shooting, so clearly it's this one." We had knowledgeable investigators who would testify that here's what these terms mean, here's how they relate to actual events that I can prove occurred.
Yeah.
Yeah, when you rap about silencing the witness and then you actually murdered the witness, like, that is not right. I mean, that correlates.
That is straight kid suave, right? I mean, for sure. And we've got, like, I do want to use this because I have it. Rod's lyrics. Have you ever told your mama you got charged with murder? Visitation, she crying. Look like she turned purple. Hands shaking, on my knees, asking God to take me in the courtroom, sweating, praying, lie fumble his that he fumble his statements. I mean, what other case is he going to court on, right?
What other murder has he been charged with?
Yeah, exactly. I think it's pretty straightforward, and easy to correlate, but. Matt, is there something else that you think that listeners should take away from this discussion about gangs?
About gangs in general, I mean, I think it's what we all know, right? I mean, gangs in our country is a huge problem because I think, it's been put that they are the terrorists of our communities, and that's what they are. Like, they are no less a terrorist organization than some of these other, whatever you want to say from any other country, right? Because they cause just as much violence, just as much pain, and just as much damage on a daily basis. Maybe not all at once, but when you look overall at the collective impact of gangs, to say that this is not a national issue that needs to be addressed, not just on a local level, but on a national level, right? That it is something that we need to, as a society, look at. We don't want to arrest a gang member here and there. We want to take down these gangs as a whole. And that's really where our focus needs to be.
Yeah. Thank you, guys. This is
Yep. No,
awesome.
I appreciate it.
I
We
appreciate
will,
all you're
yeah,
doing.
we'll, I'm gonna sign off and let Christy sign off, but good to see you guys again. So yeah, see you later, twin. EA's up, B's down.
Bees down, man. All right.
If it isn't clear already, the truly destructive nature of gangs reaches every corner of the community. As you will hear in our next episode, the gang's ability to hide its activities, or portray them as something else, led to long delays in solving the murder of Rebecca Foley. But failures in the police's approach to the investigation and delays in the criminal justice system kept Rebecca's mother, Jennifer Foley, from even beginning to see justice for the murder of her daughter for over 5 years. Worse still, all of the cases are still not fully resolved. Join us as we talk about justice delayed.